This one I've entitled Waging War or Forging Peace, and trying to tie together some of the sessions that I did over the week. Now, how many of you, is this the first session that you've been at of ones that I've done? Okay. The rest of you were at least at one other one. So then, I guess the place to begin is to say that in my sessions this week, I've been suggesting that there is something slightly off course in U.S. foreign policy. And someone asked me earlier in the week the question, I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. For those of you who don't know, my name is Joel Muggy, and I'm the director of the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College. Someone said earlier in the week, it almost seems as you're saying there's nothing right about U.S. foreign policy, that there isn't, we don't do anything right around the world. And I said, that's not really the point I'm trying to make here. What I think, if we look at individual places, there are some things we do right and some things we do wrong. But what I am trying to say is that there is something fundamentally off course about our policy, about the way it is designed and the assumptions that go into determining the policy. And today what I want to try to do is look at some of the underlying assumptions of the policy and where those assumptions have led us. And I'd also like, if we have time, to take a look at some alternatives to the policy. I want to begin with a quote by George Kennan. This was written in 1948, and at that time Kennan was the director of the State Department, the director of policy planning for the State Department. And I think it really can be said that Kennan was one of the architects of the post-war period in terms of the direction of U.S. foreign policy. Let me read his quote. "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 3.6% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. The final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by local government. It is better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists." Now, that's a bit of an unnerving statement if you think about it very long, in terms of the kind of assumptions it operates about how the world is going to work in the post-war era. Now, I would suggest that our policy, particularly our foreign policy since the Second World War, while it's been moved one direction or another by various administrations, has had all too much of Kennan's viewpoint there as its underlying theme. And what we see in Kennan's words, I think, is the laying of the foundation for the national security ideology that has really been the driving force in U.S. foreign policy since World War II. The national security ideology is an ideology based on the notion that the most important priority is defending our nation at all costs. Translated, defending our way of life at all costs. The NMI in 1948 was defined, and in the post-war period, was identified as the Soviet Union and the something called the International Communist Conspiracy. And central to that ideology, and I think we're seeing it so well exhibited, particularly in the current administration, was this idea, or a very dualistic notion of the world. in which all international conflicts are seen as manifestations of the struggle against international communism, or more specifically, a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. In 1947, the National Security Act was created and instituted, and that and a series of other measures established the CIA, established the National Security Council, and a number of related agencies. And these measures essentially provided for a kind of parallel state structure that was in many respects inaccessible to the public and to Congress. And we've seen that again and again over the years. And we see it again in the whole Iran-Contra business, that there is a whole level of decision making, of budget, of military budget especially, that's really outside the reins of the at least structures of government as we know them. Congress has at various times tried to check the power of these structures, especially the CIA. We've seen that at various times, and that seems to bring it into line, we think, for a while. But I think what we fail to recognize is the extent to which this kind of para-government keeps operating from one administration to the other. In recent years, I think out of this national security apparatus, there has emerged a very sophisticated strategy that is really being utilized in particularly our relationships with the Third World. And that's the concept of low-intensity conflict. Now, this is not a phrase or a term that's sort of been created by, peaceniks or people opposing a particular policy. But it is a very concrete military strategy that has been articulated in a number of ways by defense personnel, Pentagon people, and so forth. Let me try to lay a little of the framework, at least, for this doctrine that has merged from our national security ideology. Neil Livingston is a Pentagon consultant who in 1983 said, "Unfulfilled expectations and economic mismanagement have turned much of the world into a hothouse of conflict, capable of spilling over and engulfing the industrial West." Livingston sees the Soviet Union as using this discord in the Third World to undermine the West, to wear it down, to deny it strategic materials it needs for commerce. "Given the magnitude of this threat," Livingston says, "the security of the U.S. requires a restructuring of our war-making capabilities, placing new emphasis on the ability to fight a succession of limited wars and to project power into the Third World." General Maxwell Taylor, many of you remember him from the Vietnam days. Taylor was really the architect, I think, for the rationale for our involvement in Vietnam. And he wrote following the Vietnam War, quote, "As the leading affluent have, quote, power, we may expect to have to fight to protect our national valuables against envious have-nots." So again, there you see the kind of ideas that Kennan was expressing earlier, again reflected in the words of Taylor. I think both of these formulations begin to define the parameters of what has become known to military strategists as low-intensity conflict, or shorthand LIC. And that's become a very common jargon term for describing low-intensity conflict. The theme of the haves versus the have-nots that Taylor articulated in the quote above is perhaps the most important underlying premise of LIC doctrine, this notion of haves versus have-nots. In essence, it states that the privileged nations of the industrial North, are vitally threatened by the starving non-white masses of the undeveloped South. And therefore, we must seek to combat any forces in the third world that seeks to reconstruct the world system in a way that reverses this flow of wealth from south to north in the way it's now moving. And so what you really see happening is in the way in which we direct our foreign policy. I think there has been a change since World War II in some respects, in that especially in the last few years have we seen a kind of thawing of the Cold War, and as we now are appear to be reaching some kinds of armed agreements with the Soviet Union, we see the focus sort of turning 90 degrees in terms of who the enemy is. The enemy is not so much the Soviet Union, unless of course it's their involvement in stirring up things in the third world, but that the enemy is more, from the standpoint of low-intensity conflict, is really seen as the threat that the third world poses for us. Colonel John Wagelstein, who's commander of the 7th Army Special Forces, has defined LIC as in the following way. And this, of course, is a definition he accepts, I mean, believes is important. Total war at the grassroots level, involving political, economic, and psychological warfare, with the military being a distant fourth in many cases. And here you see another very, very important characteristic of low-intensity conflict, that low down on the list of priorities is direct military confrontation. But that first, the head of military engagement is a political war, economic war, and psychological war. And so you see, for example, in Nicaragua, I mean, we have not had direct involvement of U.S. troops, right? There have been contras. But again, look at the way in which we have been most involved in the political war that goes on, in the economic war, the economic boycott against Nicaragua and so forth. That is to say that LIC is warfare that falls below the threshold of full-scale military combat between modern armies. That's not, you know, like Iran-Iraq or say our involvement in Korea in the 50s. It's something less than that. It encompasses really four kinds of basic operations. Four kinds of basic operations, and then a lot of things that support those operations. The first operation is counterinsurgency. Now, counterinsurgency means combat against revolutionary guerrillas, usually in one shape or another, at least defined as Marxist guerrillas. Whether or not they are, in reality, that's usually how they're defined. Now, who is engaged in this combat is important, and I'll come to that in a moment. But nevertheless, one part of LIC is combat against revolutionary guerrillas. And we see that very clearly today in El Salvador. We see it in Guatemala. We see it in the Philippines and in other places as well. And the second kind of operation is a pro-insurgency operation, and that involves U.S. support for anti-communist insurgents, or guerrillas sometimes. And where do we see that happening? Nicaragua? Anywhere else? Angola, UNITA in Angola. And so that there's support for insurgents that are avowedly anti-communist, or again, anti a regime that we perceive as communist. The third kind of operation are what are called peacetime contingency operations. And these are like police actions, kind of using rapid deployment forces. There we do get involved militarily, usually, with small forces, very quick, in and out. The invasion of Grenada was a good example of that kind of thing. No war is declared. There's no full-scale military engagement of armies. There's no doubt about, you know, minimal casualties. You know, there's no potential for real loss. Or the 1986 bombing of Tripoli, Libya. Remember that one? That quick, kind of surgical attack almost. So those kind of peacetime contingency operations. And then the fourth operation is what's referred to as a military show of force. And we see those in a number of places. We saw it early on in the Mediterranean with respect to Lebanon. We see it now in the Gulf. The presence of U.S. military forces as a threat, as a kind of an intimidation to whoever it is we're attempting to intimidate. And of course, the best example is the constant U.S. presence in Honduras and the periodic maneuvers involving thousands of troops inside Honduras close to the Nicaraguan border, or the presence of U.S. warships off the Nicaraguan coast. That kind of show of force to intimidate various parties. Now, there's a number of additional principles to LIC, and perhaps the most important one is the idea that it's important to use local forces rather than U.S. troops or U.S. forces to carry out as many of these operations as possible, especially the counterinsurgency and pro-insurgency aspects of it. Okay? And so we see in El Salvador today, we don't see much involvement of U.S. troops, but a heavy, huge bill of millions of dollars going in to support the government of El Salvador to carry out this policy, and with us having maybe 50, 60 military advisors in the country. Or, of course, in Nicaragua, we use Nicaraguans and exiles to carry out that function. So as much as possible to use local forces, local police agencies in the Philippines, and we talked the other day, the use of these vigilante groups to promote this kind of strategy. Often this, as in the case of the Contras, this takes the form of hiring or co-opting armies of almost thugs and mercenaries who then really starve and terrorize the local population, and they become too weak or frightened to resist. Now, another principle of LIC is that it targets the population, not territory. In other words, it's a strategy to win the hearts and minds of the people, if possible, away from those who are the communists, so to speak, if we want to define it in that way, or at best to isolate them from to isolate the insurgents from their potential source of support. So you see the bombing of areas to drive people out of an area of insurgency. In Guatemala, we saw strategic hamleting, where you put people together, move them off their lands into places, where they could be watched and guarded. And you see this in many cases, that attempt to separate the people or the insurgents from their source of support. And this, of course, was really developed at its finest in the so-called Phoenix operation in Vietnam. And that strategy continues today in Central America and the Philippines. Thirdly, another additional principle is the idea that the military must coordinate with civilian intelligence and development and humanitarian aid workers. And so you see, for example, in El Salvador today, many who analyze the El Salvador situation point to clear collaboration between USAID and the Salvadoran military, and how U.S. economic aid is utilized in order to shape conditions for the war in El Salvador. Many more right-wing humanitarian aid organizations that are often kind of co-opted into the political arena. One very now well-documented example, and this is not characteristic of their work all over the world, but was World Vision in Honduras, where it was really exposed the way in which World Vision was collaborating with the U.S. Embassy in promoting an anti-Contra policy in terms of the providing aid to Contras and calling them refugees in Honduras. So you see that, and another example, of course, is the vigilante groups in the Philippines that clearly have a civilian intelligence kind of function, that intelligence is then utilized by the military. That's also a very important strategy in Guatemala, where there are civilian home defense forces, which have been Guatemalan citizens who have been organized by the military and really forced to spy on their neighbors for fear of their own survival, and to keep things under control in Guatemala. And finally, a key strategy of LIC is the enlistment of the resources and the ideological convictions of the private sector to aid governmental efforts. And that's the private sector both in the country where the operations are being carried out and in this country. And so then you see, you know, the all of the spin-off from the Iran-Contra stuff that's been uncovered about private aid organizations and private business and private businessmen involved in funneling aid. And you see the involvement, for example, of key Nicaraguan business leaders in this business, and that the whole involvement of the drug trade and all of this stuff that gets wrapped up into it is clearly part of the strategy of LIC, that some of you were here the other day when I talked about the Philippines and Major General John Singlaub's involvement in the Philippines. Now a private citizen, but very much carrying out part of this strategy. Really, the theme low intensity conflict is misleading in that it implies that the levels of violence and bloodshed is low somehow. Just by the term, you think, well, low intensity, it doesn't. But that's hardly the case. Rather, for example, if you look at Guatemala over the last 15 years, which is really a perfect case of low-intensity conflict in action, there have been 100,000 people killed in Guatemala in the last 15 years. So it's hardly low-intensity in terms of the number of suffering. It's really a form of warfare in which your side suffers little death and destruction, while the other side suffers as much damage or as possible without producing undue hardships for your own society. So that's walking that careful line so that it doesn't touch us in a way that a full-scale war would. Because, in other words, if the body bags start coming back from Nicaragua, then the policy is going to have much more of a problem. It also means then this involvement in whatever area of the world has to be indistinct enough and inexpensive enough not to raise a hue and cry in Congress. And the indistinct we can see, you know, especially again in Nicaragua, and the whole denial of our involvement in mining the harbors, right? And that, you know, no, we're not involved. Well, yes, we sort of are, but not really. So it's that fuzzy sort of on the edges thing that's very much part of the strategy. A recent issue of Christianity in Crisis had an article on low-intensity conflict written by Michael Clare. Michael Clare describes low-intensity conflict. I hesitate to use this quote because it is really a very emotional quote. It's not terribly objective in one sense, and yet I think it says something about the character of low-intensity conflict. So with that qualifier on it, I'll read it. Clare suggests that low-intensity conflict is the amount of murder, mutilation, torture, rape, and savagery that is sustainable without triggering widespread public disapproval at home. Or to put it another way, LIC is the ultimate in yuppie warfare. It allows privileged Americans to go on buying condominiums, wearing chic designer clothes, eating expensive meals at posh restaurants, and generally living in style without risking their own lives, without facing conscription, without paying higher taxes, and most important, without being distracted by grisly scenes on the television set. That's pretty heavy duty quote there. But I think what he's suggesting has some truth in it, in that, and if we look at what has happened over the last few years with respect to our activities in various parts of the world, There is a clear attempt not to bring it to the level of involvement so that it will generate the kind of resistance at home that it might not. Many of us involved in the Central America work like to think that maybe we've been successful in keeping U.S. troops out. I'm not so sure that's true sometimes in my more cynical moments, because in some because I think part of the policy is insofar as possible to keep the troops out, because then it would really generate this reaction. I think finally a key strategy of LIC is the war at home, as it's called within military strategists. And that has at least two phases to it. One is to keep the U.S. public as unaware as possible of the realities of LIC and the results of the policy. So it means very careful work with media people and so forth to help them shape the news in the right way. And a constant calling, you know, bringing in media people and so forth, interpreting our policy for them. To keep them as unaware, us as unaware as possible of the realities of IC and its consequences. And then secondly, I think, is the strategy is to overcome the resistance of those who do begin to speak out against U.S. intervention in third world conflicts. To really see, and I think many State Department strategists and defense strategists have articulated this, the need to really try to put the muzzle on in one way or the other by discrediting people or whatever, the voices that speak out against intervention. So I think it's clear, at least it's pretty clear to me, that low-intensity conflict, and Michael Clare makes this point in his article, that low-intensity conflict and American democracy are essentially totally incompatible with each other. That to the extent that low-intensity conflict is a policy of our government and or the underside of our government, if you will, that is a really a direct affront to our national democracy, and that really our integrity as a nation and our humanity are at stake in this campaign to carry out low-intensity conflict. I'd like to talk about one other thing in terms of this strategy, in terms of helps us define who the enemy is. And I think this is coming back again to this question of the national security ideology. I think there is at work within our understanding as North Americans and I think we've been very much conditioned to think this way because of the kind of assumptions underlying this policy, that nations and governmental systems and so forth lie somewhere on a scale between democratic capitalist systems on one side and totalitarian socialist / Marxist systems on the other side. And that systems or governments or whatever lie somewhere between these two spectrums, or either here or here, or somewhere in between. I think actually this administration, there isn't much in between. You're either here or you're there. I mean, there's that kind of them or us sort of mentality. And I think if we look back at our own lives, lifestyles, and our educations, we've all been conditioned pretty much to think in those kinds of terms. You know, these are the good guys, the democratic, capitalistic kinds of systems, and those are the bad guys. And I'd like to suggest that I think there's a somewhat more sophisticated way to think about that, that maybe more reflects reality as we understand it today. And that is to see this relationship as somewhat more of a matrix. And in that matrix, then, the top we would call democracy. And down here would be totalitarian regimes. And over here we'd have capitalism. And over here we'd have socialism. Marxism. And then, once we've done that, then we begin to put countries, place countries on in this matrix according to some sorts of criteria about how we define them. Now, I'm not going to suppose that this is any kind of scientific study. Someone could probably do this and make this more scientific. But just in terms of our understanding of how certain nations and systems function, then we begin to realize some interesting things. Somebody like Stalin would probably be down here, right? But somebody like Pinochet in Chile would be over here, or Hitler perhaps over here. Most people would put the United States, I suppose, somewhere up in here. We might debate about that. For want of other things to talk about, I don't think we'll debate that too much today, but that there is, at least in this framework, most North Americans, I think, would put the U.S. in there. Maybe somewhere, maybe in here somewhere, right? Kind of, and maybe with some movement this way, maybe even some movement this way, right, as we're... And as we are coming to see that. Well, then I'd like to suggest that if we do that, sort of at least at this point, just at an intuitive level, from my own experience, suggests that a country like El Salvador, which our country touts as a real democracy, I would find belongs down here somewhere. And I'd suggest that Nicaragua maybe is somewhere in here. Okay, leaning towards socialism, but certainly not a fully socialist state in the sense that 60% of the economy is still in the private sector. It's certainly a country that is opting for a kind of a socialist project, but it's more over in here. And a country in which, if democracy is defined the participation of the majority of the people in the decision-making process, then I think, while Nicaragua certainly has some restrictions on freedoms, or at least has had in recent years that are not consistent with our understanding of democracy, if we understand democracy to mean the participation of people in the decision-making process, then I'd say there's still a substantial... amount of democracy at work in Nicaragua. And then if we could go on with this and we could debate about where countries belong, but I think you get the idea of the formulation here. And what I'd suggest, again in a kind of oversimplification, but yet to trying to make a point here, is that one of the tragedies of U.S. foreign policy that has grown out of this ideology that I've been talking about is that we have, as a nation, tended to support nations that fall in this half of the matrix. Rather than, if we're really true to our principles of democracy, if we really believe what we say we believe about democracy, and that the motivating principle is democracy, not the extent to which a country adheres to capitalism, then we ought to be supporting countries in this half of the matrix. Okay, you see the point that I'm trying to make there? And that would put us, in my opinion, in an entirely different relationship with a country like Nicaragua, as well as the current government of El Salvador. I want to make a few more comments about this whole national security ideology, but let me stop here and let you raise some questions and get feedback from you. I am going to Say a few words of hope, too, by the way. So if by now, after all these four sessions, you're in the pits, why? Comments or questions? Yeah.
Maybe your words of hope will deal with this, but I'd like to address how do you deal with low-intensity conflict? And I have to think about the debate about the Vietnam War. It seems that, ironically, something like the Vietnam War probably strengthened low-intensity conflict, is that right?
It was really a testing ground for it, you know, and I think it did. It helped people see what worked and what didn't work, and I think it did strengthen it, yeah.
And also, like the government, I would think, the people that favored low-intensity conflict, to think that in order to avoid another Vietnam, you've got to do the other.
That's right, yeah. And certainly, the whole question of the war at home became very critical. It's one of the problems with LIC, I think, in Central America. It's too close to home, and there are too many people beginning to understand that situation. So the war at home becomes very critical for LIC strategists, because it's too easy for people to... It's not halfway around the world like the Philippines is. There it's easier, see? I think... One of the elements of hope that I wanted to point to is precisely, and how do you fight it, I think is the whole question of understanding and knowledge that it's going on. And that as more and more people become aware of that dimension of our national strategy, it'll become harder, though not impossible, it becomes harder to keep that alive, at least some of the manifestations of it. And I think to a certain extent, that's been true in Central America. So I think that one of the elements of hope is simply that it's become recognized as a part of our strategy. You know, it's the idea of low intensity conflict is not, as I said earlier, it's not something that people who are opposed to our involvement have created. This is you can read about it in military journals, all sorts of places. You know, I mean, it's there. Barry, you had a question.
I was just going to make a comment. It's just supporting your suggestion about the way we're conditioned to look at socialism. About 10 years ago, I taught high school for a few years, and I taught international politics to a bunch of high school kids. And I did some stuff on socialism, and to begin that section before we ever talked about it, really sort of to get at what you were talking about, I asked them, so not to define socialism, but to tell me which countries in the world were socialist. And I got Uganda under Idi Amin. I got, I can't remember the list, but with the exception of one, which was Sweden, which was by someone who was from Sweden, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah.
They were all completely totalitarian governments. And that's the way then they defined it. When I asked them, what is socialism? The terms used to define socialism were completely in terms of a dictatorship or totalitarian kinds of terms and definitions. Had nothing to do with economy. That's what they
did. Yeah. And see, there's also, I think there's another level of this in terms of conditioning us at home. Dan Erlander was telling me a story about, I can't remember the setting, where he asked a group of high school kids to draw him, if he were to draw a picture of an Arab, what it would look like. We can imagine the images they all came up with. I mean, this person had fangs, they had, you know, ammunition belt around them, in traditional, you know, the Arab dress. I mean, it was this incredible picture of an Arab, right? That is, well, we all know what the stereotype is. We've all been raised with them also. And so that creating, that kind of attempt at creating the enemy in a way that reinforces the policy, I think is something we have to be very, very careful of in this country. Yeah, right.
Appreciate your matrix. Are you suggesting that our decision as to what nations to support and to oppose are influenced analytically by that matrix, or are you suggesting that it's a happen?
Well, I don't think somebody in the, I don't necessarily think somebody in the State Department has this matrix out in front of them, you know.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but I think let me put it this way. I think that economic considerations are all too often the judging point for our relationships, rather than, if you will, political or moral considerations here. And I think, and that's very consistent with this national ideology strategy.
So we find ourselves quite willing, perhaps, to support a government which is really totalitarian because it's economically to our advantage.
We need the copper.
And that's the drive.
Right. It's right. Yeah.
That same thing might be true if you need a copper and power to get it out of the socialist country.
It's possible. Yes. But the problem is, I think, that we... perhaps that would be the key if we could begin to see the possibility of relationships with socialist countries. But see, there is an ideological thing that gets in the way also here. I had a very interesting conversation with an Australian diplomat on the plane out of Nicaragua once. He's the economic officer for the Australian government at their embassy in Mexico City, which also serves Nicaragua. And this was in 82, I believe. And he was he said, we as in Australia see Nicaragua as a pretty good place to do business. I mean, not great, obviously, but that it's a place where there's some good, you know, there's some money to be made and so forth. But see, then what happens is that even where there is the possibility of that, then the ideological issues, I think, get in the way, and the anti-communist.
I've been thinking, for example, Tanzania, for example, China.
Yeah. China now.
A few more bucks in there, and I don't think their government form would bother us in the least.
Right, right.
It's a lack of capital, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I read a book by Susan George. It's entitled Fate Worse Than Debt. And she's noted, too, in terms of this whole, the economic notions behind our national security and how to preserve our way of life, in that by and large the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, policies now toward debtor nations is a threefold policy. One, to encourage export crops.
Right.
Two, privatization of banks. And three, the deregulation of all those commodities. And when you do all those things, and when you have all those third world nations doing that, what it means is that the world market is flooded with cheap natural products. You know, cheap bananas, cheap coffee, cheap copper, cheap tin, whatever. To whose advantage?
Ours.
United States and the six other Western economic powers have all bought this kind of policy by the IMF because it enables cheap products to encourage our high standards of living, and they can't pay the debt.
It really preserves that flow of wealth from south to north. That's right. What it does. And I think one of the ironies of this whole thing, too, is that in many respects, there's Peggy Lernoux has talked about this. Some of you may have read her work,
Cry
of the People, and she's done a very interesting book on banking in Latin America now, too. And she says one of the things that's really happened is our preoccupation with internal civil struggles in Central America and naming those as national security issues is really a smokescreen towards what is really a national security for us, and that is that international debt, and that we're not doing anything that's getting at that question, and so this other stuff becomes a kind of smokescreen that allows us not to deal with it.
Do you think that Gorbachev coming to power is now going to give the U.S. or his ideas are going to give the U.S. less excuse, or it's going to make it harder for them to do those things in Central America because the communist threat isn't there anymore?
Well, it may be more and more difficult to use the communist threat as the boogie band, maybe. That doesn't change the nature of what, because what we're seeing is the problem really isn't the Soviet Union anymore. We use it as an excuse. And I think what we also have to say here is that what we're talking about in terms of our sphere of influence, the Soviet Union is just as guilty of in its own sphere of influence. Right? I mean, that's what is, I think, an important parallel here. And so that in this new war, you might even begin, I mean, in its worst scenario, seeing the United States and the Soviet Union becoming allies in a strange sort of way in order to preserve that. That's maybe jumping farther than we ought to, but it's something we ought to think about. So I think there may be a sense in which it will be, if Gorbachev keeps moving in the direction he does and is allowed to and that sort of thing, it may be less easy to simply blame it on the communists, right? We'll have to rethink about it, reformulate it. But I don't think that will lessen the strategy. Yeah.
In fact, the previous remark of the identity of, say, Marxism with totalitarianism, the fact that on your matrix there are independent axes, in fact, is something which I think most Western people don't immediately have as part of their worldview. And I think it would help. It seems to me an objective observer would have a hard time putting any present state way up in the upper right.
Yeah, I would agree.
And if you had a paradigm like that, if there was a state which would clearly identify as a democratic state, which was either socialist or preferably Marxist, then it would be very difficult to make this confusion.
Yeah.
Because I just, in fact, just several weeks ago, for the very first time in my life, read the Communist Manifesto, and I think Marx would be turning over his grave at any of these, essentially.
See, I think also we'd have to say, it really, even though I put the U.S. where I did, it's very difficult to find anybody that we're going to put up there to either.
Yeah.
You know? And so that there is, that we all, they're all hybrids of some sort or another in this process. But I think your point is well taken.
I think the ironic thing is, I think Nicaragua comes about as close to that as just about any country right now, and they're the ones who are making the war.
Yeah, it certainly maybe did even more so, say, 3-4 years ago, before the pressure let up.
If anything, we forced them almost to go back into the place on the model there, where we want them to be to start with.
And in many respects, you know, 1970, 71 in Chile, in terms of the way in which they came to power was very close to that. I mean, it never got a chance to work itself out, but here's an elected socialist government.
I was about to make that as my final remark. It seems to me Chile in the early days of Allende was probably the best such example. It didn't last long because that was a country that had a very educated populace
as
opposed to Nicaragua.
Yeah. Let me try to conclude with some words about national security, additional, and then at least a word or two of hope here, because I think there really are some. This whole idea of national security has been an important concept in U.S. foreign policy for a long time, and we've justified all kinds of interventions and military activities abroad on its basis. But I don't think any administration in recent history has been as preoccupied and as had the kind of the single-mindedness and the ideological fervor embrace this concept as the Reagan administration has. I mean, it is the core of its policy. And so I think we could say they've been preoccupied with it. And that's why it's especially ironic to me to suggest that I think our present policy of national security is putting our own national security at risk. And I think that's finally the grounds on which we begin to argue this point, that what we're doing is detrimental in the long run to our own national security. It's been increasingly clear in recent years as we look at our actions in Central America, instead of working towards a negotiated solution and putting our efforts behind first the Contadora peace plan and then the Arias plan, instead of doing that, we keep lobbying for aid to the Contras, and we step up our campaign to overthrow a democratically elected government, Nicaragua. But the important point is we pursue this policy in spite of the fact that we're virtually alone in the international community in our position here. There are virtually no countries anymore that support us in our current stance towards Central America. Even the presidents of Nicaragua's neighbors a year ago, all of them were speaking out against aid to the Contra. By signing the Arias plan, they essentially said, no more aid to Contra. A year ago about this time, 8 foreign ministers of other Latin American nations came to Washington, pleaded with Schultz to stop aid to the Contra. They were rebuffed. So we, virtually every nation in Western Europe, with maybe the exception of Great Britain, opposes our trade embargo against Nicaragua, and our actions are generally regarded, in Central America, are regarded as violations of international law. In the Mediterranean, instead of our putting our efforts towards the solution of the basic problem of the home of a homeland for the Palestinian people, we've escalated the violence by striking out at symptoms of the conflict, like when we attacked Libya, or getting ourselves embroiled in the Gulf and the potential catastrophes that could occur in there, as recently happened. And again, we're virtually alone in our policy. Remember the outcry from European nations when we attacked Tripoli. And I think these kinds of actions are very gradually kind of putting cracks even in our NATO alliance. There's widespread opinion abroad that we are employing the very kinds of terrorist tactics we claim to abhor when we engage in this kind of activity. Now, the Reagan administration maintains that our policy is necessary to maintain America's strategic alliances and enhance U.S. credibility. And I think the reality is it does absolutely the opposite, certainly in the international community. Our big stick policy accord against Nicaragua is spreading anti-Americanism across this hemisphere to an extent it hadn't existed since Rockefeller's car was stoned, you know. And could lead, it could still lead to the loss of American lives. And furthermore, when we identify our interests with groups that are gross violators of human rights and which show little regard for democracy, as we have done with the Contras, I mean, that's, I think, the best example. Or when we take this benign sort of attitude towards the vigilante groups in the Philippines, or for that matter, when we embrace the Israelis with the unquestioned fervor that we do, I think we betray our most basic values and our credibility as a nation is destroyed. National security is enhanced by cultivating friends, not creating enemies. And I think our policy is really creating enemies in many parts of the world. At many levels, and I think it's a sane policy, and the only way to reestablish our credibility is to really chart a new policy that replaces this kind of either quick fix military solutions or a kind of low intensity constant gnawing away at the fabric of a society with dialogue and negotiations toward long term political solutions. I think there is hope at this. I mean, in spite of the kind of things I've said this week, there is, I think, a good deal of hope. And I'll just say a couple words about my sources of hope in this struggle. First of all, the primary source of hope for me is consistently the people in the places that are the potential victims of this kind of strategy. It's the people of El Salvador, the people of Nicaragua, the people of the Philippines, the people in the Middle East, the Palestinian people and Israelis who are working for peaceful negotiation, these are the people who are the source of hope for me, because they're the ones who teach me what courage is and how this kind of strategy in the end is not going to succeed. You know, the fear is that it will destroy us. I mean, in the end, it's going to come back, I think, and destroy us as a people. But it's not going to destroy, there's going to be a lot of suffering, but it's not going to destroy the people the poor who are the sort of the victims of this in the end. I think a second sign of hope for me is the increased numbers of U.S. citizens who are aware and speaking out on these kinds of issues. Central America has been, I think, a good example of that, and while it isn't, that is not translated as much as it ought to other areas, I do think, in spite of some of what I've said, that the level of U.S. involvement and awareness of what's happened in Central America has been had a tempering effect on our policy in the region. I hope that's true, and I think There are, I mean, I think we see the majority of people now speaking out against contra-aid, have been. I think the kind of, the support that no matter, regardless of what you may think of him as a potential leader, the kind and levels of support that Jesse Jackson has had, given the kinds of policies he represents, which I think are, I think gives a sense that there is something afoot in the universe, something afoot in this country, in terms of a rejection of these kinds of policies. And finally, I think, and it's really would take another session to deal with this, that another thing that gives me hope are people who are seriously working on alternatives to the present policies. People at maybe not enough in government, but who are close enough to government that I think there are some potential for these policies getting a hearing. One of the groups that I've been closely aligned with is a group called Policy Alternatives for the Caribbean and Central America, PACA. And they've just published a new book, Forging Peace, The Challenge of Central America. This is just a summary of it. But they really have developed a fairly comprehensive strategy for an alternative strategy towards Central America. One of the people who's been intimately involved in PACA is the policy director for Jesse Jackson's campaign. So there is a lot of thinking going on. I'm afraid it's still short of the reins of power in many aspects. And of course, there's always the danger that what we're talking about here is such a para-governmental structure that it continues no matter who's in power. But yet I think that this kind of picking away at it is eventually what it takes. I think the good news is that it doesn't take a majority to change. It takes a critical mass, and that we certainly, that may be in fact manageable. Let me stop and ask and give you a few more minutes. One of the things that I'll add one more word then, and that is, you know, the question that you're not asking is, what can we do? I think one thing that's very important to do, and people often don't see it as an action, and that is to continue to put yourselves in positions to learn about this. I mean, it is a concrete action to allow yourself to continue to learn about things that aren't too comfortable to learn about. I think many people hear a little bit and turn it off, will not allow themselves to learn anymore. So I think the first concrete action is for to continue to open yourselves to the possibility of learning, and whenever possible, to learn from the people of the third world. Don't listen to me, you know, I mean, listen to the people who are there and experience it. It's nice if you can go there, but you don't have to. Those people are here too. And the people of the third world in this country, or so-called third world peoples, people who are also experiencing reality from that of the oppressed, the position of the oppressed. We just had a very interesting thing that happened in Detroit in June. A year ago, we had a group of people who were inner city people from Detroit, together with people who worked in humanitarian or community organizations in Detroit, went on a trip to Central America. They came back to this country and said, we want to host a travel seminar to Detroit. And so we had people, they were the hosts, people lived in their homes, took them around agencies in much the style which we conduct a travel seminar in Central America. And other people, sort of you would say non-poor in the U.S., many of whom had been to Central America, some of whom had not, went to Detroit. And the people of Detroit were the teachers for those people for understanding the reality of what it means to live in Detroit today, which is quite a reality too. And that's that we want to do more of that kind of work, because I think it keeps bringing these issues home.
I think one thing too is when you live outside the U.S., you see the growing anti-Americanism.
Yes.
And the Americans have done a lot of good in the world, and I think that's because they are capable and have the resources. To see that fall apart because of these policies
is really sad. Very, very important point, I think. Very, very good point. Yeah, because it's ironic. I said in my session on Central America, much of what helped the awakening of the poor in Central America was actually work of Peace Corps workers and church workers from the U.S., you know, with very good intentions, you know, and then that created its own...